Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your 30th Street Studios of musical analysis and film grammar. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. You're listening to Miles Davis's Go Ahead, John, from the record Big Fun, with the insane John McLaughlin solo and the panning back and forth between the channels, the stereo channels. I mean, come on. It's a great song. Used in a scene in the new Miles Davis biopic called Miles Ahead, which we are here to talk about today with Nate Chenin. Hey, Nate.
I'll play it and tell you what it is later.
Oh, what, it's going to be one of those. Can we just use Miles Davis quotes for the entire thing?
You know what? Let's not. I feel like we need to rise above.
In this movie, which was directed by Don Cheadle and stars Don Cheadle as Miles Davis and was made using crowdfunding and stuff like that, right? I mean, he really put himself forward. He had to make this movie, and he did it by any means possible. And he gave interviews about how, in fact, the reality of the situation in Hollywood is that you can't just make a movie about a black genius trumpet player. You have to make it a buddy film with a white, a handsome white co-star.
As he did,
which I actually loved the forthrightness of that interview, those interviews. I felt that they were sort of Milesian. And at the same time, I was disappointed that it was a buddy movie with a handsome white co-star. But
it was more than a buddy movie, was it not?
Okay, well, let's say why. Tell me.
Well, I mean, how would you characterize this film? It's sort of a buddy pick. It's kind of a heist movie. It's sort of a blaxploitation film. It's kind of a biopic. It's maybe some sort of fever dream of artistic impersonation. It really kind of doesn't sit easily within any of those categories, which I think is very much intentional.
Yeah, and some critics have compared it to Citizen Kane in terms of the...
Well...
Not in terms of its excellence, but in terms of its plot idea of here's the once great figure in a down cycle, a bit confused and depressed and fixated mysteriously on something from his past, which has kind of a mystical significance. So, where are we, Nate? I mean, look, I think you and I maybe had slightly different reactions to this film. I tried my best to watch it not as a jazz specialist looking for mistakes and all that, because I don't want to be that guy. I understand how a Hollywood movie needs to elide over certain things and fudge certain things in order to tell a story.
I sense a but coming.
But at the same time, Miles Davis was a genius and a great artist. I'm not quite sure that I understood anything on that level about him any better than I did before.
But understanding better might be an impossibly high bar for you, Ben Ratliff, music critic, jazz authority to set for this film, don't you think? What would you possibly glean that would be new from an experience like this? You who have delved deeply into the music and the mythology of Miles Davis.
Well, I think that a great actor and a great, perhaps a great screenplay could tell you something about his interior life.
Okay.
I mean, my very first encounters with Miles Davis were so perplexing in the most generative way, in the kind of way that made me feel, wow, I have to spend the rest of my life knowing more about this guy. As a teenager, I heard his records in the 50s, and they were all cool and beautiful and sort of so deep and fascinating and elegant. And then I saw him when he came back not long after the action in this movie, and I just could not wrap my head around it. I thought, is this possibly the same person? This guy with the weird shades turning his back on the audience, playing dissonant clusters on the keyboard, how could that be the same guy? And I found it so deeply mysterious, and I just wanted to know what made him tick. So anybody who had anything resembling that kind of thought might come to this movie and say, well, this movie might shed some light on that question.
Well, I'll counter by saying that that essential feeling of confusion that you just divulged, I think that's kind of baked into this movie. It's a film that has multiple views of its subject, and I think that Don Cheadle works pretty hard to embody a character that is not fixed. For a moment, maybe we should issue a mild spoiler alert and say, you know, this is a film that somewhat counterintuitively sets itself in one of the very, very few periods in Miles Davis's career when he was out of the public spotlight, not making music. As you said when you brought up Citizen Kane, this is kind of a peek behind the curtain of a reclusive period,
right?
Like a sort of, you know, an exile. And then what that gives Don Cheadle and the filmmaker, the other people involved in making this film, you know, what gives them a kind of license there is that it is sort of a blank spot in the public record. Right?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So you're free to invent things.
So what do we know about this time? Well, we know that he was, you know, doing drugs. We know that he was not playing the trumpet.
Yeah.
You know that he was involved in some pretty like shady people and shady dealings. And we know that he was holed up in a brownstone, you know, in the West 70s. What this movie does is kind of imagine, you know, this crime caper emerging out of those circumstances and kind of frames his comeback as this sort of thing that's just out of reach. And if only he can, you know, I guess we'll just say it, there are these session tapes that are sort of set up as like the Maltese Falcon of this movie or something. And they are absconded with. A big chunk of this movie is like, we got to get that tape.
Right.
We just got to get that tape. And that's where the gunplay comes in, and that's where all kinds of crazy stuff goes down. So that's all an invention.
Yeah.
Like all of that is just whole cloth invention in terms of the plot mechanism.
Right.
Back to your idea of like the beauty of Miles Davis and the mystery of Miles Davis, and then the weird kind of unbeauty of some of the music he was making upon his return. I think that's all in this movie. You get sort of the idea that this guy is a poet, a sensitive and creative soul, and he's also kind of a monster. You know, maybe doesn't fully understand his own motivations part of the time.
Right. One thing I thought of is we have a lot in the film. We have a lot of footage of him interacting with people that he doesn't respect. And I don't know enough about his period of exile to know who he was dealing with every day. I wondered about that a little bit. If we want to get to the truth of somebody, maybe we need to show him a little more with people that he does respect to bring out some of who he really is at the essence, you know? I read Don Cheadle's interviews saying that he wanted to make a movie about Miles that Miles Davis himself would have enjoyed.
Right.
And he picked up on some of the characterizations of Miles that have been used actually in recent critical and academic works about Miles Davis, mm-hmm. of like Miles Davis as pimp,
right,
metaphorically, or who knows, and Miles Davis as gangster, again, metaphorically, or who knows.
Both of those characterizations also kind of spring from the pages of Miles' autobiography, written with Quincy Troupe.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of attitude in that book that I think is sort of recaptured or channeled in this movie.
Yeah. But don't you think that Miles Davis was essentially a failed pimp and gangster?
He was not a pimp of distinction.
So he was a failed pimp and gangster, and he was a great artist.
Right.
So
why
ultimately,
focus
I don't,
on that?
Yeah, ultimately, I don't really want to spend that much time meditating on, you know, the truth of his inner pimpness and gangsterness.
Well,
a few references to it, cool.
Yeah. Well, that's part of the tragedy of this movie, right, is this idea that he's kind of self-effaced in some way.
Yeah.
You said that it would be cool to get some example of Miles working with people that he respects. One of the really magical parts of this movie for me was the flashback to Miles in the studio with Gil Evans, mm-hmm. Working on, I think, Porgy and Bess. You know, and this small run of albums that he made with Gil Evans, you know, it remained until the end of his life some of the proudest work that Miles Davis himself had done.
Yeah.
You know, like, he regarded it really highly.
Yeah.
In a film in which really one of the main themes of this movie is kind of the struggle to assert some kind of agency or independence of white control, which is something Miles talked about quite a bit. There really is, thematically, there's a lot in this movie about sort of ownership,
mm-hmm.
you know, and even sort of slavery. He uses those terms, you know, and this idea of, like, who owns my music? Who owns me?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who owns the masters? There's one line in the offices of Columbia Records, his label, when Miles goes in and pulls a gun and actually fires a shot, you know, in the office of George Butler, his producer at Columbia. And after he leaves, there's a manager, a white manager, who turns out to be kind of the arch villain of this movie.
The A&R guy?
The A&R guy,
yeah.
Right. But he's a manager too, right? He's managing a young trumpeter,
okay.
who's kind of the foil.
Named Junior.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the line that this guy says after Miles leaves is, he's like, what a waste. He's probably more profitable dead than alive now, huh? And that seemed like a line that was inserted with, you know, with a lot of knowingness,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think you and I probably both watched this movie in a screening room at Sony, which still, you know, distributes all of the Miles Davis reissues and has released, you know, these deluxe box set after deluxe box set of his music. And so it was a line that kind of, I don't know, sent a chill up my spine somehow.
Yeah.
Because I thought, it's true. I mean, it's demonstrably true. Miles Davis has been far more profitable posthumously than he was in his lifetime.
Right.
You know, it's just one of those funny little details that I think is put into this movie with a kind of wink.
Did you feel that he was presented as a contemporary artist? In other words, did you feel like some of the things that he was saying and the way his artistic philosophy was represented in the script, did you get the sense that the filmmakers were trying to show that, you know, here's a guy that would have been current today, you know, his thinking was always up to date?
Hmm.
Or challenging the norms, or there was a line that might have been taken from an actual interview where he says, I don't like, please don't call it jazz.
Right.
I prefer to call it social
music.
Did you recognize that from an interview?
I did not recognize that from any interview that Miles Davis did.
Yeah.
But it is a term that we've talked about here on the podcast. It's what John Batiste chooses to call his music.
Yeah.
I do know that Miles he sort of bridled at the word jazz. He wasn't particularly fond of calling himself a jazz musician.
Nor was he alone in those feelings.
But I don't really have any association between Miles Davis and the phrase social music.
And at the very end, in an imagined scene where he's playing with the real Wayne Shorter and the real Herbie Hancock and Esperanza Spalding and et cetera, isn't he wearing a jacket or something?
Yeah, with a vest.
A vest that says hashtag
social music. Hashtag
social
music. Yeah, which is so strange. But that's kind of the moment when we're, I guess, sort of jolted back to the present.
Mm. Okay. Things I liked. I liked the sense of playing with time and setting and breaking through between the present and the past. For instance, when he's in the elevator in the Columbia Records building,
mm-hmm.
and he's looking at the album covers on the wall of the elevator, and I think he sees Someday My Prince Will Come with his former wife on the cover, and he's kind of goes into a reverie, and then he opens a door in the elevator, into another time period.
Yeah.
And another scene where he is encountering somebody at a boxing match in order to settle some business, and all of a sudden it becomes sort of magical realist, and there's Miles Davis's group in the boxing ring.
Right. And it's actually sort of the 1960s Miles Davis band in the arena playing, and then 1980s Miles Davis in the audience,
yeah,
about to conduct his business.
I thought those were very creative ways, yeah, of the problem of needing to tell the story in several different time periods,
yeah,
at once.
I totally agree. And there's often a very sort of, formally, it's pretty interesting. You know, there's a lot of sort of jumping in between present and past, mm-hmm, and the present being, you know, the early 1980s. And often what Cheadle does as a director is those moments are done with a jolt rather than a dissolve. You know, there's like a squealing of tires, or there's a slamming of a door,
right,
or there's a gunshot or something. And they're always kind of like very disruptive. And that seems interesting, you know, especially in a movie in which there's a tension between sort of the burden of the past and sort of the all of the great accomplishments that are behind him,
yeah,
and sort of this uncertain and very tenuous present into future that Miles Davis is facing. Those scenes that you just mentioned, especially the boxing ring scene, were singled out by our colleague Manola Dargis in her very positive review of this movie. And there's a line in her review that I'd like to read. "Purists may howl, but they'll also miss the pleasure and point of this playfully impressionistic movie." You know, I'm not a purist. It is very difficult for me to disentangle myself from, you know, my investment in all of the arcana of jazz. It's hard to be sort of willfully naive of some of that stuff. But to that point, I actually thought there were lots of little flourishes and grace notes in this movie that seem to be playing directly to the connoisseur.
Yeah, such as?
Well, there's a scene, I think early in the movie, when Miles is alone in his apartment. He lights a cigarette with a burner, a gas burner, and it's a blue flame. And if you're familiar with Miles, the autobiography, the very first scene on the first page is he talks about remembering the feeling of seeing Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah.
And he talks about how it lit up something like a blue flame.
Hey, nice one.
Now, immediately after that moment, he's listening to the radio.
Yeah.
For some reason, and I think this may actually be the most implausible thing in the whole movie,
mm-hmm,
he's listening to WKCR.
Mm-hmm.
And Phil Shapp is talking about Miles Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And playing, I think, So What?
Mm-hmm.
And he's going on and on about, you know, what a masterpiece it is, how great this piece of music is. It's like the best thing that Miles has ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And this agitates him so much that, mm-hmm, he calls the studio,
yeah,
and he gets Phil Shapp on the line.
Yeah.
And he says, "Listen, you talk too goddamn much."
And then he says, "Play Sketches of Spain."
Yeah, right.
Nate, that actually happened.
Did that really happen?
Yes, it did.
Were those actually his words?
Close enough.
I did not know that that was a real story, but
yeah,
it made me laugh. It made me laugh in the, you know, and I was sitting next to another jazz person and we kind of like elbowed each other in,
yeah,
the ribs. There's no reason for that moment to be in the movie,
yeah,
necessarily, but it's one of those things. It's like,
it's a detail. It anchors it in,
yeah,
in specifics.
And I feel like textually speaking, there's a lot of stuff that they get right. One of my pet peeves with any movie about music and music making is that it just looks fake. It doesn't feel right. You know, the miming of the musical playing,
mm-hmm,
is wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I think it has to be said, Don Cheadle does a very good job of mimicking trumpet playing.
Yes.
When there's a rhythm section playing behind him, it looks like it's actually happening. It doesn't.
Yes.
It's not like that sort of classic old, like, awkward Hollywood thing where, you know, the drummer is playing a beat that's not being heard on the soundtrack.
That's right.
So all of that stuff, I think, is done really well.
Although Cincinnati, Ohio did quite a poor job of pretending to be New York City.
Well, this is true.
So let's go from New York City, or an imagined New York City, to the West Coast.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable.
That is Chet Baker singing My Funny Valentine. Nate, there's another movie out there.
Yes, there is.
It's also about a jazz trumpeter who is having some drug-related issues and not at the high point of his career. His name is Chet Baker. There's a film about him in which he is portrayed by an actor.
This is a movie called Born to be Blue, and the actor in question is Ethan Hawke.
So aside from all those things, the trumpet, the jazz, the drugs, the woman as muse, what's the link between the two movies?
You know, I think about 20 years ago, there was an essay by a scholar in the jazz studies realm named Kryn Gabbard. And this essay was called Signifying the Phallus, Mole Better Blues and Representations of the Jazz Trumpet. And in this essay, he talks about the ways in which the trumpet is, you know, always depicted in jazz films as a sort of, you know, a phallic proxy. There's something that gets circulated in the lore about, you know, when the trumpet player is no longer able to hit the high note. You know, this happens in a lot of jazz, old jazz movies, you know,
right.
Young Man with a Horn. I mean, it's a recurring thing.
Mm-hmm.
And in Mo' Better Blues, it's actually this like very wrenching scene of physical violence where, you know, his mouth is smashed. This is Denzel Washington's character, Bleak, who's a trumpet player. His mouth is smashed and he's basically rendered impotent. And this to me was the thematic bridge between Miles Ahead and Born to be Blue. There's a scene in Miles Ahead when Miles, who has been, you know, this kind of this recluse, this, you know, sort of degenerated soul in his lair, he takes out his trumpet and finally, you know, he tries to play a note. And this is in the presence of Junior, the young, you know, the young hotshot.
Right.
And Miles is not able to get it up, basically. There's a similar scene in Born to be Blue after Chet Baker actually has his mouth bashed in by his former dealer. And this was based on fact. You know, this actually happened. And in this scene, I guess he has his new sort of dentures in, and he's, you know, his mouth is still, you know, looks like tenderized meat, basically. And he gets into a bathtub with his trumpet and tries to play. And, you know, it's just the most sort of melodramatic moment.
Yeah.
You know, he's spitting blood. He's, you know, he's coughing. He's sort of curling up in a fetal position.
Yeah.
And again, it's this idea of, you know, he's been emasculated. He's been completely rendered impotent in that moment. And so that to me felt like the bridge. These are both movies about the artist in exile.
Right.
You know, and struggling to regain some kind of footing.
And trying to live with themselves as, you know, emasculated versions of their former selves,
right.
You know, or something like that. It's interesting that you bring up this thing about trumpets and the essay, you know, because, yes, there's this incredible sense of macho obligation running through these movies. These guys have got to be men. They've got to show somebody. In the case of the Miles movie, they sort of have to prove it to Frances, the wife, who is sort of a better human being than Miles Davis. And Miles is sort of saying, I could have hung on to her, you know, even though that was going to be impossible as long as he was punching her.
Right.
In the Chet Baker thing, it's something about his father, maybe, you know, needing to please his stoic Oklahoman father. That's the kind of stuff you hang a Hollywood movie on.
Right.
Again, can I ask the question? Chet Baker was known to be quite a good musician. And even it's a little bit controversial. What kind of good musician was he? Some people acknowledge that he had something, but he wasn't great, or, you know, and then comes the confusion about, well, why wasn't he great?
Right.
I'm not sure I learned anything like that.
I would argue that Born to be Blue completely fails as a portrait of an artist in a way that Miles Ahead does not. I came away from Miles Ahead understanding, you know, this sort of portrait of someone who feels music and has a sensitivity to creating music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really felt that. In Born to be Blue, it the trumpet and jazz, it kind of felt like a sports movie in a way, you know, where he was just trying to get back in shape.
Yeah.
in the scenes where music is portrayed, it's unconvincing. And maybe we should note that Miles Davis is a character.
Yes.
Kind of a pivotal character in this Chet Baker movie.
Yeah. He sits in the back of a nightclub.
He's
in
the
one
skeptical
scene
bad guy.
And glowers.
Yeah. And there's a weird sort of coded racial dynamic at play there.
Sure.
Well, I think the character of Chet Baker says to himself, kind of psyching himself up, like, watch out, Dizzy and Miles. Mm-hmm. There's a little white kid from the West Coast who's gonna, you know, knock you out, mm-hmm, or whatever he, mm-hmm, says. You know, there's like a chip on his shoulder that specifically has to do with earning the respect of the East Coast African-American innovative jazz musicians.
Yeah, which perhaps he never quite did, or never did to his satisfaction.
Right.
And the antipathy from Miles Davis toward Chet Baker was real. I mean, that's something,
right,
that comes up in Miles Davis's autobiography.
Yes. The contour of Born to be Blue is the, you know, it is a much more conventionally plotted and sort of standard issue arc. You know, here's the character, here is the essential conflict,
yeah,
and here's what he does to struggle with, you know, and then ultimately, you know, make a choice. That is, turns out to be, in the movie's telling, both sort of tragic and triumphant,
yeah,
which is he chooses to continue to be a junkie and just kind of follow his own path. He goes to Europe, and
which,
you know,
also is true.
You know, the thing that's kind of funny and self-defeating about that is that it basically points the way towards a much, much better and more evocative film called Let's Get Lost by Bruce Weber,
yeah,
which is all about sure, the late period Chet Baker.
And it was a documentary.
Right. But a documentary that feels not very documentary-like.
That's true. It's hazy and it flows in weird ways and it does feel almost fictional sometimes. And you felt that Chet Baker was playing a character, like that maybe in real life to some degree, Chet Baker was playing the character of Chet Baker.
Right.
That's how the movie made you feel.
Well, the movie opens with a premise of Chet Baker playing himself in a movie. You know, the opening scenes of the film are shot on a movie set.
Of the new film, the fictional film.
Right, right. Born to be Blue begins with Chet Baker turning onto heroin for the first time on screen. And there's a funny moment when, you know, the director says cut and Ethan Hawke asks Chet Baker, says, shouldn't there be like more vomit? Like, this isn't how it went. Like, you know, so there is a little bit of, you know, self-consciousness there about sort of, you know, representation.
Yeah.
You know, but I fail to be convinced in this film that Chet Baker is not even a great musician, but like an interesting musician.
Yeah.
You know?
Since you made the comparison to Let's Get Lost, the documentary, can we just talk briefly about biopics in general and whether they are the right medium, whether they can be the right medium to deal with a great jazz musician, let's say? Oh, we could say a great musician, but we're talking about jazz. Is it the right medium to deal with a great jazz musician?
Can I lob that back with a, you know, is a biopic ever the right medium? Ever? For anything?
I always come away feeling frustrated in ways that I don't feel frustrated when reading, let's say, a novel about an artist.
Right.
You know?
I think one of the problems is that, you know, these biopics tend to embrace these formulaic aspects. And it's funny, as unconventional and non-narrative as Miles Ahead often is, it still embraces these tropes. And, you know, there's sort of the, you know, the demon of drugs, mm-hmm, and self-destruction. The idea that, you know, that the music is sort of salvation, but it's all tied up with this sort of this evil energy. And there's also the sort of the love of my life who is pure.
Yeah.
You know, and I am inflicting all of this damage because I am a tortured artist.
Right.
You know, all that stuff is, I mean, it's so old.
Yeah.
For some reason, it's really hard for people who make these movies to imagine an alternative.
I think it's because people are afraid of jazz. They still are.
Boom.
The idea of jazz is so frightening to most people. It seems so impenetrable that if you're going to tell a story for a general audience, you're going to, you know, well, there's no question. You have to use these totally old, outdated narrative ideas that don't necessarily have much to do with the artist or the music. With one asterisk, I still think that the thing about shifting between time zones in the Miles Davis movie had a kind of like improvisational feeling to it, like vaguely jazz-like.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of Cheadle as Miles versus Hawk as Baker?
I thought that Don Cheadle was better as Miles Davis.
And did you think,
I thought that he settled into that role more deeply and allowed a deeper settling of character and also possibly a deeper research.
I thought he was pretty extraordinary. It's somewhat easy to settle into a pretty surface emulation of Miles Davis. He's somebody who has a distinctive raspy voice. Every musician who's ever worked for him has a kind of impression of him. I was kind of amazed at how quickly that idea was dispelled for me when I watched the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I believed in the character. And the character was dynamic. You know,
mm-hmm.
Those time zones, it wasn't just like hairstyles and wardrobe that changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he really did sort of communicate a kind of multidimensional character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the case of the Chet Baker emulation, it felt a little bit, I don't know, maybe I've seen too much Ethan Hawke. It felt more Ethan Hawke than Chet Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's another thing there, which is that, you know, there's a musician ghosting the trumpet playing in Born to Be Blue.
Yes.
But, you know, they made the decision to have Ethan Hawke sing himself. And I'm sure it would have looked and felt really weird to have him lip syncing.
Yeah.
There's probably no way to win there. But, I mean, let's be honest. Chet Baker had a pretty miraculous voice.
Yes.
It was sort of an uncanny reflection of his trumpet playing, but it was also this otherworldly thing. And Ethan Hawke just kind of sounds like a guy who's, you know, trying to sing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Chet Baker's voice had a different and new and almost radical version of masculinity in it,
right.
You know, and I think that's one of the things that really lingers about him is like, whoa, there's not a lot of dudes who sound like that, you know? Scenes I would have loved to see, maybe they were left on the cutting room floor, I don't know. I would like to see a movie about Chet Baker and Dick Twardzik in 1955 on tour in Paris. You know, two musical geniuses, one known to everybody, one totally obscure, and the pianist Dick Twardzik dies.
There's your tragic buddy movie.
With, you know, just a really sad heroine death. And what does Chet Baker do at that point? Does he know that he's made some of the greatest music of his career? Does he say, wow, I gotta quit heroin? I don't know. I'd be so curious to see what a filmmaker do with that. And with Miles Davis, I would just love to see Miles Davis in the Gil Evans salon on the ground floor apartment on 50th Street or whatever it was that's been written about so often next to the Chinese Laundry, you know, where John Lewis and all these different musicians would pass in and out and exchange ideas about their art, what they were doing. Wow. I mean, I'd love to see a little bit of that. But again, I'm coming down on the side of I want to see a movie. If we're talking about really brilliant artists, I want to see more of them interacting with people that they respect.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Twardzik. The scenes of music being played in Miles Ahead feel they have a lot of kinetic energy and they sort of pop, right? Or do you not agree with that?
Yeah, some of them do. Yes.
Imagine if Born to Be Blue had that level of skill applied to a flashback of Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan, you know, doing their thing.
Yes.
You know, just like sparring, interweaving, you know, bobbing and weaving.
So that you understood, ah, this is why people were so excited about
right.
this guy.
Something's happening here.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just a beautiful trumpet tone playing a melody. There's some quick thinking. There's some instinctive, you know, action.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was entirely missing.
One of the positive things about Miles Ahead is that they enlisted Robert Glasper to deal with the music. And just like you said, there are some scenes where the music is really popping. So Robert Glasper, the pianist, musical director, right?
Yeah.
To some degree. And he made a record related to his involvement in the movie.
Right. There is a soundtrack, which, you know, in which he kind of put together sort of a greatest hits of Miles, but filtered through the lens of this movie. But then there's also an associated album that he released himself, which was much more sort of loose and, you know, sort of an impressionistic take on Miles as an inspiration.
Right, and it dealt a little bit with the question of what would Miles Davis be into today?
Right.
Which directions would he be going in today?
In a post-Dilla world.
Yeah. So why don't we hear something from that record, Violets, by Robert Glasper with the rapper Fonte. Nachinen, thank you very much for coming and talking about film today.
My pleasure, sir.
Tiggalo, 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 tiggalo. Yo, blues and greens and violets. Eyes get heavy with the weight of the world around the iris. It's like something insane. It's like a virus. It's like a hybrid of all your joys and your pains that you bring to the table periodically and memorize them like a scientist.
Let them know.
For you to make it, dog, you're gonna need alliances. A blessing and a prayer from the whole archdiocese. Ticker, let's put it to rest, cause I'm so in need of one. I only hear about it, never really seen it done. Everybody asking when I'm coming out, so when I run around.
That's our show, and thank you for listening. Thank you to our producers, Andrew Chow, Tamara Best, Jocelyn Gonzalez. Listen to music related to these movies on our Spotify playlist. Hope you enjoyed this, whether it came to you through iTunes or Audio Boom or Stitcher or whatever. And we'll see you next week.